Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Today with us, we have Kyung Chan. Kyung is the Managing Director of Out the Back Ventures. Kyung, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Christian. Nice to be on.
Awesome. Hey, so why don't we start? I love the name, Out the Back Ventures. What's the backstory?
Yeah, the backstory, we never intended it, John and I, my co-director, for an Australian vernacular. But this in the background is actually my hometown, Perth, Western Australia. Did this deliberately because we talk to people all around the world. I do a lot of that every day, and people want to know where Perth is. So this is 10 minutes down the road. It's the real thing, unedited. This is the photo. But Out the Back Ventures is connected to this, to the ocean. John and I are surfers. So when we think about Out the Back, if you talk to anyone who surfs, they know immediately what you're talking about, which is that first wave that you see, everyone's paddling to that wave. If you've got a friend, like in this case, it could be John, or you see other people on the shoulder of the wave, they'll be pointing out back, or they'll be furiously paddling to go out that way because they know that the second one is better, or the third one. They come in sets of threes. So now, I suppose the analogy, and I think we were quite drunk when we came up with this, but the analogy was that, that sometimes it's not the first wave, it's that second and third. And I think a lot of people would probably understand that, you know, like it's in investing, it's and finding and being involved in all the startups like what we are, we have to be looking about, you know, things in the next 5 to 10 years. So that takes a bit of a different perspective to be able to see that. So hence the name and also the connection to Australia, which was coincidental, accidental in a lot of ways.
Well, you pulled it off because it's brilliant on a lot of fronts.
Thank you.
You're welcome. let's translate that then into the investment thesis.
Sure.
Longer time horizons, you know, please fill us in. You know, what are you looking to invest in?
Yeah, so we, Out the Back Ventures, we are a specialist on university research translation into startups, in particularly in deep tech. So our investment thesis is that, we come in very, very early. So we are generally the first check. Not only do we co-invest in the first check, generally with universities and other angel investors, but we also co-found the startup. So we bring management and teams to the stars, which is often the tricky part when it comes to early stage research, because you're dealing with researchers generally.
And so, I've been exposed to university accelerators, and there is I'd say a theme. Obviously, it's not ubiquitous, but I've heard it enough where, you know, the technical prowess of the founders or the team is, you know, impeccable. But, you know, maybe just given where they are in their career, the business experience isn't there yet. So what's your experience been? And if it mirrors mine, like how are you starting to address the business component?
Yeah, I mean, we've had the privilege, Christian, of, you know, looking at I don't know how many types of different models. We, you know, as a back a bit of context, we operate in Australia, the Netherlands, the UK, and also in the States. So we've had, you know, we've got a pretty unique perspective on this. You look at university accelerators, I think in general, they tend to be something like, you know, 12-week courses to teach or mentor a university research to found a company. Sometimes, you know, it's not to say that it doesn't work, but they generally, you know, find it in terms of engagement and traction, it's really challenging. It's hard for researchers to become people that are, you know, experience of business, I suppose, and within 12 weeks. It's like me trying to be a researcher in 12 weeks. You know, it's unlikely, right? So not to say that isn't a valuable part. I mean, it's certainly a lot of experience, you know, that people can learn from that. But I think what really helps, you know, from our perspective is when we decide that we want to co-found a startup with a researcher, generally it's filtered from the university. So, you know, universities that we know will reach out to us because they know that we can help form the company, We can support the researcher with business and commercial, activities and nows. Takes, for myself, not to say I'm the answer to all questions, but almost 20 years in early stage investing. So you just, gather a lot of information and experience through the journey of different ways to take concepts to market, and how to raise capital in between that as part of that progress. But I think that's how we support them. So it's a bit of a skill, and I'm happy to talk about that further.
Well, yeah, so let's unpack that. So I imagine there's no shortage of amazing technology being developed at universities around the world. What's your guys's selection criteria? Like how do what's the process by which you start making decisions of whether or not you want to get behind something?
Yeah, that's a great question, Christian. A lot of people ask the same question, understandably, because there's so much going on. First of all, universities are they're large corporates, right? They're big organizations. But the part that we deal with is around the technology transfer. So some people may not be familiar with that. Tech transfer is essentially exactly what it means. It means taking the IP that's at the university and transferring that to a company or external party, generally by license or something in that form. That tech transfer component, they're actually highly skilled at selecting projects, and I'll delve into that a bit deeper. They generally have a budget that's provided by the university to patent and patent IP. They can't help everyone. So what happens is that, at the university, the researchers will disclose, they call it information disclosure, right? Or invention disclosure, to the tech transfer office. And they will then make a decision based on, do they think that there's something here that they can be protected in the form of a patent, or do they think that there's something that's got commercial opportunity and or, right? Actually, when you develop the relationship with tech transfer, and that's taken the better part of 4 to 5 years now. So we know a lot of tech transfer people, and we view them as, as our community. We're part of that community. That's not an easy thing to do. People find it, a bit difficult sometimes to deal with them, but certainly not our experience. But they were the ones, Christian, who tell us, look, Keong, we like this project. This researcher, they're really, really good. We've invested a lot of money over them over many years in terms of their IP protection. They just need some help to be able to form it into a startup. So that filtering mechanism is hard-earned, but actually very, very valuable when it comes to deciding or being able to figure out which ones to support. And the tech transfer offices, they will generally take a longer-term view. So I can think about, I mean, AI is a big deal, right? And I think I've heard on previous podcasts, Christian, the AI has been better part of 20 years worth of research to get to this point. So it takes some time, and what happens is that in research, there's an awareness of things coming down the pipe in the research community that mainstream and investors don't really know about. But that part there is really, really valuable, and that's the part that we get onto. And a lot of that filtering, coming back to your question on which ones select, they have a very good sense of what is coming down.
Interesting. Are you ever in a position to see what they passed on for purposes of investing in patenting technology?
Well, generally they won't. And by the time they reach out to us, because they've kind of filtered a lot of that stuff. So, is the research quality? Is it novel? Does it have commercial opportunity? Is there a commercial opportunity there? Is the res Are the researchers or the researcher, the lead professor, are they good people? In terms of being able to work together, not everyone's a yes. So, I assume that, through that process of the invention disclosures, and then to the point that they patent something and then they come talk to us, there's probably three or four levels already before they talk to us. So that's kind of like how we move forward.
If you think about it, there's a lot of risk on, pre-revenue, early technology, let alone deep tech. But, it's wise. I think it's wise what you're doing because you're kind of mitigating your risk by having the benefit of the university to effectively do some portion of due diligence by the time it gets in front of you.
Yeah, I think also not due diligence from that point. That's very helpful, obviously. But I must also add that A lot of universities have their own funds now, so you might be aware that they have their own funds. So that's an investment, Christian. That's not a grant. That's do we think that this thing's got a chance? So when they reach out to us, they have already made that decision internally that they want to put some money into this into the project to co-invest. They just need someone to help shape it up.
And nothing speaks louder than putting your money where your mouth is. Totally.
Definitely.
Hey, can we take a step back? I'd love to hear what your career progression looked like leading up to out the back.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned earlier, hard to believe almost 20 years of early stage investing, and I know that because my son's 17 now. So, I've been doing this a while. During that point in during the last 20 years, doing it in a self-employed capacity slash unemployed capacity, allowed me a lot of flexibility to work with a lot of different people. And I've served on public company boards as, as a director, as a chairman. Can you believe I was in that position at some point? But the last 4 or 5 years has been specifically in Outback Ventures and working with universities in that translation piece. Myself, I've had the privilege also of becoming good friends and working with a lot of family offices and high net wealth individuals. That's actually as our funding source, the syndication of those type of investors is where we generate a lot of capital. Because I think if you think about it, the fact of being a family office or high net wealth, something's happened along the journey. They generally are very entrepreneurial, and have a great sense for investing in things. And they probably, I would say most times, come in earlier than traditional VCs.
And so, was there a pivotal moment where you said, I'm going to focus on university research?
It came a lot, it's during the COVID era, Christian. So, it was a lot of self-contemplation. I ended up being on 4 to 5 company boards, interest on those boards, and I enjoyed that experience. It's good to, I suppose the buck's got to stop somewhere. So, a lot of discussion, a lot of deliberation, at board levels about decisions, strategic decisions and things like that. But I've always been interested in where these startups have come from universities, and a lot of them are really impactful. So if you think about AI, or you think about nuclear fusion, or a lot of different areas of research that have translated into really outsized returns for investors, they probably have originated from university or at some point touched the university in a meaningful way. So how do we do that repeatedly? So yeah, it was probably. It was quite a long time. It's probably 6 to 12 months of contemplation about what I wanted to do with my next phase of my career. And yeah, it was a big move, I mean, for our family personally, to be able to kind of draw a line and say, okay, that was quite kind of what happened before, and now stepping out, 4 to 5 years, and at this point, working with the best universities in the world, in this space. So it's also been quite, if I think about it in hindsight, where we were 4 years ago to now. I mean, I'd be delighted, but I didn't think it'd be like this.
Awesome. Fantastic. So, all right, so let's head over to making some investments. So
Yeah.
getting exposure to I presume some pretty impressive deep tech or deep technologies that these universities are bringing to market. What are some of the things you're really bullish on right now?
Yeah, I think I just came back from a trip, probably my fifth or sixth trip to Knoxville in Tennessee. We're pretty deep in that ecosystem, in that community of researchers. It's probably, if not one of the, it's world class, I think, Christian, and especially in nuclear technology. So we're big believers in nuclear. There's a lot of, as people might or might not be aware, I mean, there's a whole heap of interest in hitting the headlines, I suppose, in news cycles on things like small modular reactors. The idea that reactors can be mobile, well, that's pretty novel. And then you've also got the fourth gen nuclear reactors, which effectively means you can design and build large scale reactors at far lower cost. There's a lot of technologies around that. And then it's probably an awareness now with the AI workload and how much compute's required. Where is all this power going to come from? So for example, the US, I think there was a recently there was a bit, they were looking to close down a lot of nuclear reactors, and now they're thinking about, geez, how do we get these back up? Because we need the base load, base load power support of this compute. And geopolitically, with China, I think there's also an awareness that for most people that China's bringing on a lot of reactors and putting a lot of power on. I think I have, China has put on the whole of the US energy grid in the last 10 years. So, they're accelerating it at not. So nuclear technology, Christian, is a big part of our thesis. We understand through talking to researchers, especially around Oak Ridge National Lab, that a lot of the technologies, even the ones that I've just mentioned, they are predicated on older types of technology, which have been incrementally improved. But we're looking at really foundational, new foundational research, which means that if you think about it, if you start with with something that's not quite great, but you incrementally improve, you can make it better and better. But if you start off with something that is designed fit for purpose, the theory is that over that period of time, you can actually exceed the incremental growth because something has been designed from the ground up to be for that purpose, to be good. So a lot of the nuclear technologies are 30, 40, 50 years old that have been that incrementally improved, and they've kind of rebadged for as new technology, but the researchers know it's not that novel, right? So there's a huge amount of innovation that can be unlocked there at these new at these at the startup thing the startup stage. And then the other thing is neuromorphic computing, which is an area that we have focused on for at least 2 to 3 years now. And that is the idea that that you can have chips that function like the brain. And because they can function like the brain, it's only 20 watts of energy, tiny bit of energy. So to be able to do so much compute so efficiently, which is very different to the current silicon way that you've got amazing companies like NVIDIA, et cetera, that people are aware of. But there's this growing field of neuromorphic computing, which has been there for a long time, but it's starting to improve in its commercial readiness and it's really accelerating at the moment.
So I'm out of curiosity. So I mean, what I hear is just, conviction around trends, energy consumption or increasing demand for energy. And so knowing that the time cycle for universities is to move technologies down, do you find that you're generally starting with, hey, I'm bullish, or think there's, big economic outside for a theme? And then I'm going to keep searching until I find the university who's working on solving what I'm interested in? Or do you find that the universities are inspiring in you, and then you're looking at these problems and saying, you know what? I think this thing could have legs.
I think it's probably the latter, because we deal with, we national, Oak Ridge, we deal with Oxford University, we deal with, Delft University in the Netherlands. I mean, these are prestigious, very, very, accomplished places for research, Christian. So what you find is that when you go in with an open mind to the universities and they contact us or they refer us to certain researchers, you see trends, and you see that somewhat the recent particular university will be focused in an area and then another university is focusing on something similar. So once you'll be able to see, like in those two areas, nuclear and neuromorphic, and for example, in quantum sensing is becoming a big thing now. So you just start to be able to see the trends of where research dollars are going, and what they're thinking about. And again, I want to draw an analogy, to AI. AI was in the labs for 15, 20 years. I mean, it came, around that 2007 mark was the first paper that was published, I think, by Stony Brook University. No one really cared about it at the time, but now that paper, using GPUs for high compute, is now like that laid the foundation. So anyone who kind of was aware of it or thinking about that, I mean, that from a financial investment point of view, I think they've done pretty well. And the same thing can be extended to nuclear fusion. The amount of investment has gone to fusion energy. Nuclear fusion is in the billions and billions and billions of dollars. So I just want to point out that I suppose awareness of these transfers from an investment point of view is really valuable. If you take many, many bets, because it's early and low valuations generally across the group. If imagine, Christian, if you took generally when you look at these in these pools of early stage research, you have 20 to 30 researchers around the world that focus on this area. So in AI, there's the common names that now are celebrity status, right? I mean, people know them really, really well now. But if you had laid in that 20, 30 group, maybe 10 to 15 of them were thinking, or maybe 10 of them were thinking of their own startups in that area. Imagine if you laid bets early, you wrote small checks, 20K, 50K, just and spread that around to a few of those. You have no problems now. From a financial point of view, I think you've done pretty well.
Well, it sounds like you've discovered a great source of alpha, and obviously there's a tremendous amount of risk the earlier you start, but just this idea that you're attacking it with something that's been incubated for years goes a long way to mitigating that risk. Okay, so with that though, you find something, you believe it's a great match, investments made. What's the degree that out the back is going to get involved with the founders and bringing it to life?
Yeah, I mean, we've got quite a few examples of that. These pieces of research and the spin outs, that's a lot of time the terms used as these spin outs of these startups. We will go into co-found, so we'll be part of the co-founding mix. We prefer that the researchers have a really big stake in the startup, so that's it's an incentive for them as well. And we will, as I mentioned before, Christian, we will write that first check with the co-investment. So, if it was, say, a 500K pre-seed round, generous valuation in the sense of being very attractive for investors, we will go halves with the university and other investors. So we will syndicate that 250K that's ours on our side with like-minded investors, and we've got a pool of investors, family office, high net worth that basically take every that will be in every deal. So that's very, very valuable, and we're obviously looking to grow that in specific countries, to specific universities, specific ecosystems. But that is our model of being able to syndicate, raise that capital in conjunction with the universities and obviously other high net worth people.
And obviously a whole host of functions are required to bring a business to life. And earlier you mentioned about supporting the founding team. So does scope include like sales and marketing,
Yes. Yeah.
service delivery? What's in your experience, where do you find like the sweet spot is with getting involved?
I think the most valuable part, I mean, we call it commercial readiness level. It's basically a fancy term for the commercial pathways for the research. So while the research is improving, so we will fund that. They call it technological readiness level, TRL, within the university ecosystem. Generally we try to get from a 3 to a 4, which is still on a scale of 1 to 9. 3 to 4 means that it works outside the lab. There's early signs that it works out of the labs. That's where the value inflection point is. But while the research is improving, the CRL is the commercial readiness. So as an investor, you'd ask, okay, that's great research, wonderful. Who's going to use it? Who's the potential customer? Will they trial it? What does that relationship look like? That's the part that we work on. So if it was to do with quantum sensing, that's great. That's an interesting approach to research that we think is really novel. But we'll then start reaching out to people in defense. We will start reaching out to the primes, the tier one suppliers, to the primes. We have a lot of those relationships within our network. And what we want to see then is that we want to see, Christian, we want to say, yes, that is really interesting from industry. That is really interesting. We would like to start entering into discussions to be able to trial that technology for further integration, into our system. So that's where we focus a lot of our time, the CRL, the commercial readiness level. But the other important part is then finding people to then want to be part of it, whether in management or be part of the team. Our thesis, and it's proved to be true, is that the caliber of people that you can attract to a startup like these are early. But if you can get them out of the lab, you can answer some questions around, okay, these are the parties that have expressed interest that want to work with this particular startup in this type of research. They and say a runway of 2 years, in terms of capital to be able to use for operating the company. Other CEO is much, much better than at this point when it was still in the lab. So it's been a really it's proved to be a very, very true thing that if you can get it early enough, but at a stage where it's got the starting to have that foundation of looking forward that you can provide to a good, these are good people, right? These are hard, they've got a lot of choices generally. Good CEOs or good people who want to run these companies, that's the point in time that they really pay attention because they're, well, if I spend 2 years on this, my equity position can be significant because I'm still coming early, but it's not still in the lab. All the IP transfers happen, a lot of the foundational things have happened before, and to enable them to do what they need to do.
I think it makes good sense. So I'm curious, in your conversations with your family offices, you are you finding that there's, reoccurring, misconceptions of, what it's going to take to commercialize the research that you're bullish on?
Misconceptions from wh whose point of view?
The family offices?
Generally not. Like they are, I mean, again, I think a lot of family offices have made their wealth through entrepreneurship, like to do things that are risky, a bit crazy, right? And it's that's what kind of like what happens. And they've obviously been really successful at it. I think a lot of, well, the, no, I think I did a lot of conversations we've had with family offices. They are very, very interested in being involved in something that other people don't know about. So, family offices are competitive. They are they are families. They like to compare notes with other families. If they turn up to a party and they say, "Well, I invested in a nuclear technology company out of Oak Ridge," they'll be like, "What the heck? How'd that happen? Tell me more." So I think that's a, it's an interesting thing that from our point of view about those dynamics at with family offices and how they make decisions. We're fortunate to have quite a few supporting our business. They are large family offices. A lot of these decisions are made very informally about making investment decisions. So effectively, they've made a decision to invest in all of our startups. So, which is so beneficial because you can imagine, Christian, come the next round or the extension of those relationships, they're actually very, very influential, right? So. If a family office is already in the cap table, people know that the money is good in the sense of being able to have the capital. It's now to the team then to deliver, on whether it's a technical milestone or some sort of, commercial milestone that they're trying to hit.
It's fascinating. As I'm sitting here listening to you, I mean, obviously family offices or LPs in a lot of early stage type funds, but if you the profile itself lends itself brilliantly to something that's, pre-seed or, but more importantly, deep tech, right? Because yeah, there's a tremendous amount of risk, but yeah, you just think of the profile. That's how they got there. They had to take risk.
And they have direct ownership, right? With our model, because they're not coming in through the fund, so they have direct ownership in the on the cap table. They will appear on the cap table, as an investor. So, I think that's another really big point of distinction. I mean, the VC ecosystem has a role in the place. It's an amazing, it's enabled so many amazing startups. But I think that when you think of when our experience is that when you deal with something as early as what we are, and we're taking multiple bets, across all these emerging fields of research. Generally difficult for VCs to invest at that point in time, because they're pre-formation of teams, things are unknown. It is risky, right? But I think if people knew the projects we were working on, they're all at very, very key inflection points now. So from a valuation uplift and from a follow-on, investment profile and things like that, it's actually a really good, great place to be.
And so, I'm really fascinated by this because, generally speaking, where we're encountering companies is, further upstream, seed A. Though, we see deep tech, but they've started to prove a degree of commercial viability. But I'm curious, do you ever see instances where there's like this conflict between like scientific integrity and like trying to make the product work commercially?
In terms of what the researcher saying too much or being too bullish on their expectations or
Yeah, I
what
mean,
do you
it's a good way to see it. I mean, we all know that, businesses need to generate money
mean?
to proliferate, but at some point you either have to, now go to the bathroom or get off the pot. I'll try to be light. I mean, Do you see at some point where maybe, things are getting pushed forward just because they can't sit on anymore? Or is it no, is it do you find because these are all universities that they understand that this just comes with the territory and they're gonna have to wait until the time is right, regardless of how they feel.
Yeah, I think I mean that's definitely a tension, there's a balance to it. Again, if I contrast the AI, it was long understood, unfortunately not during when we started this. So I wish we had started this 10 years ago. That would be really cool because I'm sure we would have heard it loud and clear that AI was more than just an idea. It was technically very, very challenging. So you've got proponents of AI who within research were like, AI is it, and then you've also got the doubters, right? Oh, that will never scale. This is not possible. Like this is fundamentally very, very difficult. But what is AI, large language models? This is a fantasy. So we have to strike that balance between the doubters and also the ones who are proponents of it, or who are thinking it could be a thing. But again, I think coming to the point, it's the noise that matters. So if you've got in research, you'll find that if the noise is loud and there's for and against, normally it's a good time to start thinking about putting some bets down in these areas because it's noisy in research land, but outside of research, it's basically non-existent, So we like strong opinions in research, and for in going both ways, it means that that point of research is really interesting and important. You'll see a heap of publications, you see a lot of conferences around it. That's and in AI, that was definitely the case, for and against. So again, had we been here 10, 15 years ago, we would have most certainly heard about that, and we would put down a number of bets with the leading AI researchers in the world, where no one really cared or knew about it. And even in the case of NVIDIA, if you delve into it and you listen to Jensen Huang's, and when he talks about the past, researchers brought the use case of GPUs for AI. Researchers did that, not NVIDIA. They were focusing on gaming, but these researchers were using it for compute. He wasn't aware of that. So again, it comes back to the point. Researchers actually do a lot of things that that are really, really important.
Well, I mean, congratulations. I mean, just listening to you, I mean, even just sitting here kind of on the edge of my seat, getting excited, thinking, oh my gosh, you may have found, and I don't know how many other funds or have taken a similar approach as you have, but I mean, it makes really good sense. If you can bring a business and investment sense by working a global wide network of connecting potential investors with technology that and I love how your analogy of this noise, it's like a marker. Been doing this long enough. I know when I see this, sit up in my chair and take note, especially if it hasn't made to the front page of the Wall Street Journal yet, that there may be an opportunity here, right? This like it's brilliant. Kyung, let me ask. Really appreciate your time. Tremendous amount of insight, a lot to think about. But like all things, I personally enjoy doing retrospectives because I find that they yield some great insights. And with that, if you had a chance, go back, have a conversation with your younger self. You pick the age.
I'm not that old, man. I'm just kidding.
Well, I've had people say, "Well, how old?" Your call. What would you share with yourself?
think, it's yeah, it's a great question, Christian. I think that, I suppose I think a lot about the mistakes that I've made, professionally. To get to this point, and it's hard earned. At one point, we were, I founded the co-founded the company that went from, and it was a public company, went to less than 10 million in valuation to 200 million in less than 3 months.
Awesome.
So, and you can imagine the deluge of interest from investors and all these type of thing. So, at the point that was quite a few years ago, I wished I knew what I knew now was that, time's really important. And so sometimes, well, most times it's when you have those type of opportunities is strategically is to admit your own, your own abilities and capabilities. And what I mean by that, had I known in hindsight, I would probably gone and recommended to the board and our shareholders at the time that we acquire one or more businesses with that capital base, because we certainly had the equity that was valuable, and we also had a lot of cash at that point in time that we could use to acquire businesses to accelerate our growth. Instead, we took the decision to build things ourselves, which ultimately led to things taking too long, because we didn't have the skill set to do that. But we knew capital structures, and we knew the M&A path, you know. So I suppose that's a very granular example of that, Christian, but I wish I knew, 10, 15 years ago, when I started doing this, is that, working with others is really important, and sharing the pie is also very important. And there's more than enough to go around with good people, because that's how, and if you look at all the, all these amazing companies, when you look at unicorns and this type of thing, I think they've been exceptional at being able to share that, and being able to bring people in and making those important strategic decisions. And that, I suppose, when decision's there, it's easy to say, but when you've got a turn left, turn right scenario, it's really, really contemplative times. You have to just deep, search very, very deeply in yourself to see what ultimately you're gonna make that decision. That's tough.
Thank you for sharing. That can be difficult, to verbalize, because I think, to a degree, it forces us to recognize that, for as sharp and hardworking as we are, there are limits, just by virtue, but no necessarily, of anything, both of our own experience, time, resources. And so, just I don't know. We're like over 80 episodes deep. I don't know that this has come up yet on the podcast. But one of the things that I've know I've had conversations with is just this idea that, founders or entrepreneurs are usually good to get from zero to one. And then as you go from one to two and up the chain, it's not that founders aren't good at it. It's just that the skill sets are different. And I don't, especially depending on, how many rodeos we've been to, this is an appreciation. It's like, hey, you got to do something different. And nothing to, yeah, you can do it. If we apply, I'm sure, look, I can tell you're sharp. If we apply ourselves, we'll win. But I think you're right. It's just this recognition that we don't know everything. And yeah, you can iterate, but recognize that at some point you're going to have to bring on other accomplished executives, other mentors, different board members, because going from 0 to 100 million is different from going 100 to 1 billion.
That's very, very true. I think, it's I suppose, in our world, and you and me, Christian, in our world, that kind of, like, I suppose, comes out in that fat in that form in terms of investments and forming teams. And I suppose, but for me, that's one kind of, like, output of that, that recognition, I suppose. But I think when you speak to people, whether they're researchers or investors, or even not in the financial world, I think that, I think it's a much better place, mentally and spiritually, when you're in that position of, it's okay, I don't know all this stuff, like, I'm here to learn. What are we doing? That moment in time, like we're having now, a conversation with someone where someone's dedicating their attention to you, and focused on what on that on those type of dis on these type of discussions. When you're at that level, that's when the real recognition of, like, what's actually going on, and having a different ideas kind of comes to fruition, I think.
I agree. I think you're spot on. Before we wrap up, question I've only recently started asking our guests, but I think it's I'm starting to believe it's telling on a lot of fronts. If you had an opportunity to see any guests that you'd like on the Innovators and Investors podcast, who would it be?
Well, yeah, I been thinking about that, and I don't know this particular person at all, and I've only heard bits and pieces. But I think there's a well, I know there's a guy, Mike Moritz, from Sequoia Capital. I mean, they're all time, right? All time legendary. But he was a journalist but in background. Really didn't have much to do with investing. I just find that I find the human element so interesting, Christian. So here's a guy who's a journalist. I think he used to write financial, write up on financial, things like companies and the markets, etc. I think that was his background. But I understand from listening to a lot of podcasts that have talked about Mike, and I've heard about on him on various podcasts as well, that he approaches investing from a very different point of view. So he's been able to pick, amazing companies like Yahoo and I think Google and these companies at these stages when they're early. And I think his perspective of when someone's saying something and their conviction and if it makes sense and that gives hope, to a lot of people, right? Like you don't need to know technically what's going on to the nth degree, but you do need to know the people. So if I had the opportunity to talk to Michael, I would be very, very interested to spend, if he did have the time, a couple of hours with a few glasses of wine and just talking about the way that he looks at things and why, and if he thinks about how he did this in the past, how can someone from a journalism background, do something like this? I find that fascinating. So that I think that's where why people like him, I would love to spend the time.
Yeah, I mean, so I think challenge accepted. I'm going to make best efforts to see if we can't get Mike on. I do think maybe perspective, it's not necessarily underrated, but I think maybe sometimes we kind of get siloed because our career starts in a certain path, not realizing that, hey, all experience is valuable. And maybe something that's, diametrically opposed to what it is you're working on, because it's going to force you to look at things in a different way, but you're still going to have that experience. I had a similar experience where I got pulled into health tech, but my background was engineering originally and then accounting and finance. And so, very objective, methodical, and, healthcare is not necessarily set up that way. But it made me think about solutions that we brought to market, with an engineering and investment like mindset. It's like, okay, influence outcomes. I can't force people what to do, but if I know I want a certain outcome, how do I treat this statistically? So I totally, I think it's a great call out, this idea that people from different disciplines could be really successful just by virtue of your experience.
Definitely. I think that's definitely true.
John, if any of our listeners want to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
I'm pretty active on my LinkedIn. That's probably my primary point of contact. And yes, have a lot of people reaching out to me because of what we do. So yeah, very happy to speak to others.
Awesome. Good stuff. And with that, again, for the benefit of our audience, Kyung Chan, Managing Director of Out the Back Ventures. Kyung, thank you so much for being a guest and giving us some of your time today.
Pleasure, Christian. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO of FinStrat Management. This has been another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com. Or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @FinstratMGMT. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.